On the Radar, an Eagle News program that takes you beyond the streets and brings you closer to national and international breaking news as it unfolds. Tune in every Monday to Friday from 1 to 2:30.
Good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to another edition of On the Reading News Bulletin. Today is Wednesday, the 7th of May, 2025, and the time is 6 minutes past the hour of 1300 hours. I am your host, Afa Happy Juju. I am here to keep you company on this, your trusted news roundup, where we bring you the latest national stories, regional developments, and global events shaping our world today. Now, coming up in today's news bulletin, the Anti-Corruption Commission makes a major arrest linked to corruption at the Roads Authority involving a fraudulent weighbridge deal and seized assets worth over 2 million Namibian dollars. A group of nursing graduates petitioned Parliament calling for urgent reforms within the Health Professions Council of Namibia. The government of Namibia planned to borrow 29.8 billion Namibian dollars during the 2025-2026 financial year to meet its budgetary requirements. So stay tuned as we break down all the stories and more. And of course, we want to hear from you. Call us in studio on 083-288-401 to share your thoughts, insights, or questions. Now, whether it's about anti-corruption, nursing graduate petition, or the government of Namibia to borrow $29.8 billion, welcome to share your opinions and ask questions on 083-288-401. Let's get right into today's headlines. The Anti-Corruption Commission, also known as ACC, has confirmed the arrest of a private individual in connection with an ongoing investigation into the alleged corruption practices involving a staff member of the Roads Authority and a private supplier. The suspect, whose identity has not yet been disclosed, was taken into custody today and is expected to appear before the Windhoek Magistrate Court on Wednesday. According to ACC, the arrest follows significant progress in the investigation, which centers around alleged fraudulent certification of an invoice amounting to over 2.3 million for the supply of a weighbridge to the Roads Authority. It is alleged that the invoice was certified and approved despite goods or services not having been delivered as claimed. The commission also revealed last week it seized assets to worth more than 2 million Namibian dollars in connection with the case. Further details released by the ACC highlight a complex scheme involving the rambushment and improper disposal of an old weighbridge which had originally been installed at the Walvis Bay weighbridge. The weighbridge was reported to be removed in May 2022 under the pretense of being transported to Windhoek for storage, but was instead diverted and illegally installed at the premises of Etango Petroleum Pty Ltd. Now, according to the commission, the weighbridge is currently being leased by the original supplier to Etango Petroleum, despite the asset not being officially disposed of or transferred by the Roads Authority. The ACC stated that it's pursuing charges of fraud, theft and money laundering, alongside corruption-related charges under the provisions of the Anti-Corruption Act 2003. Now, the ACC also affirmed that the investigation remains active and further updates will be communicated to the public as the case unfolds. We've reached out to Anti-Corruption Commissioner Spokesperson Josephine Ngituamata to provide further information on this. Let's take a listen. Good afternoon, Josephine Ngituamata, and welcome to On the Reader News Bulletin.
Good afternoon. My name is Josephine Ngituamata, and I'm so honored to be part of this program today. Thank you.
Can you kindly provide us more details about the circumstances that led to the arrest of the private individual involving the Weighbridge and Roads Authority?
Thank you for the question. Maybe just a bit of a background before the arrest was made. Mm-hmm. The Anti-Corruption Commission has been investigating a corruption-related case that is actually, I would say that it's actually involving corrupt practices, allegations of corrupt practices by a staff members of Roads Authority, a staff member of Roads Authority, as well as a supplier. Part of the investigation, it's actually, there are actually allegations that there was an invoice to which, to the amount of over 2 million, that was actually meant for the supplying, of the weighbridge to the Roads Authority, that was corruptly certified. And by an invoice being certified, there is actually an indication that the goods and services were either received or were delivered. But in this particular case, that was not the case. Also, following now this invoice, there was an acquisition, following the acquisition of the new weighbridge, there was an old weighbridge that was also, how can I put it, renovated or revamped by the same supplier for an amount of 264,960. And this new weighbridge was reinstalled at Wabash Bay during September 2021. So now, upon delivering of the new weighbridge during then the following year in May, that was May 2022, the old weighbridge was corruptly removed from the premises of Roads Authority under the pretext that it was going to be transported to Roads Authority head office that was actually in Windhoek. But in actual, and it was supposed to be transferred to Roads Authority in Windhoek for storage, which happened to be not the case. Instead, this weighbridge that was removed from that place, that actually, from which the other one was revamped, this old weighbridge was instead transported and diverted to a certain company in Wabash Bay, that is the Tango Petroleum Pty Ltd.
Yeah.
And it was actually installed there, installed in that premises. And it was when the investigation was conducted, it was determined, or it was established, that there was no approval given, and this old weighbridge was installed at that company, whereby it has been leased for a certain amount of money by this particular company. And that was done without an approval from the Roads Authority. And this actually, as part of the investigation, it actually led to the seizing of this weighbridge that was actually done last week. It was seized by the commission. That was last week, which is part of the investigation now. And as it stands, there are certain charges that these two people, these two players, who are being suspected in the this particular case are actually going to face. And in addition to corruption charges, there are alternative charges such as the fraud, theft, and money laundering, that is actually under relevant provisions in the Anti-Corruption Act, Act No. 8 of 2003.
Okay. And what is the current status of the Roads Authority staff member who is allegedly involved in the scheme? Has any disciplinary or legal action been taken?
Also now, maybe before I come to the Roads Authority officer, just to answer the to give information now as to what happened after the seizing of the weighbridge. Two arrests has been made, whereby one private person was arrested yesterday. That was the 6th of May 2025. And this is a private person, not a person from the supplying company. And today, the 7th of May 2025, another arrest was made, and this is on the an official from the Roads Authority. And as extended for the commission, now we operate as per the governing Act of Parliament, which is the Anti-Corruption Act. So, and our job is to investigate a case, pass on the information to the Prosecutor General for a decision to prosecute or not to prosecute. And should that decision given to prosecute, as in this case, that was a decision to prosecute, was given by the Prosecutor General, our job is now to spearhead or to lead that process that leads to the arrest of the culprits. And once we arrest the culprits, they appear in the court of law, and it's now upon the court to decide based on the evidence that has been provided. So as it stands currently, the two people who are arrested, who have been arrested in this matter, they will are expected to appear in court, and now we believe that maybe today after lunch or after 2 o'clock, they should appear in court, and we'll know what could be the status now of that case moving forward. Or as for now, all of us are just waiting for the court to pronounce itself once they appear in court today.
The commission seized assets worth $2.3 million. Can you confirm what kind of assets were seized?
Thank you very much for this question. The asset that we are referring to here is the weighbridge that was seized is part of the ongoing investigation that is into allegations of corrupt practices by a staff member of Roads Authority mm-hmm. and a supplier. Maybe just to give a short background on the allegations on this matter, the allegations basically pertaining to an invoice to the amount of 2.3 million, mm-hmm. or let me say rather over 2 million, for the supply of the weighbridge to the Roads Authority that was corruptly certified, thus indicating that the goods or services were delivered or received. And in this particular case, that was not the case. And you know, when you certify an invoice, that is an indication that as a receiver, you are happy and have received the goods in order as you have ordered them.
Yeah.
And that can also, what follows after the certification of the invoice is just a payment that can be factored. Right. And also in addition to these allegations, following the acquisition of the new weighbridge now, mm-hmm. the old weighbridge was then renovated and at the same time by the same supplier, basically. And this was to the amount of 964,960,000. Basically, that is in Namibian dollars. And that particular new weighbridge was also reinstalled at Dwavish Bay Weighbridge during September 2021. Upon the receiving or the delivery of the new weighbridge during May 2022, which was the following year, the old weighbridge, the one that was removed from the other one when it was replaced in 2021,
okay.
this weighbridge was corruptly removed from the premises of Roads Authority now in that town, under the pretext that it was going to be transported to Windhoek, that was to Roads Authority head office
yeah.
for storage. But instead, this weighbridge was diverted it has not been transported to Windhoek, but instead it was reinstalled actually at the Tango Petroleum Pty Ltd company, that is a private company in Wavish Bay, and since then it has been leased on a certain amount, and the person responsible or who were custodian of the leasing was the private company that was responsible for supplying the new weighbridge now in Wavish Bay. And that was done without the approval of the Roads Authority, and I could have said that the Roads Authority did not give the blessing for the leasing of that particular weighbridge, old weighbridge to this company.
Mm. Josephine, are there other individuals or entities under investigation in relation to this case, and should we expect further arrests?
I don't really want to say much about what could be the next stop for the commission. I just perhaps all of us just to be patient and watch as the case unfold itself. For the Anti-Corruption Commission, our job basically is to investigate a corrupt matter. We investigate, we pass on the case to the Office of the Prosecutor General. The Prosecutor General make a decision to prosecute or not to prosecute as it was done in this particular case. And after the prosecution decision has been made, the case is forwarded now to, once the arrest has been done, now the court take charge from then. And is currently the two members who have been arrested to appear in court, and it will be now up to the court to make a decision that is based on now the evidence that has been provided. And also our staff members, the person is responsible for investigation,
mm-hmm.
Who's been delegated, will definitely be expected to be there to either oppose bail or to, depending on what the court will say.
Yeah. You
know, the ACC also definitely have to answer to what has to be presented in court. I can say that investigation in the matter is still on the table, and I don't want us to speculate to say more arrests will be made or no arrests will be made. We just have to wait and to see how the case itself unfolds. Because the times and time again, you might arrest one person, but as the person face the court, they might even reveal more information about who and who is again involved in the matter. So we just have to wait as the case unfolds itself. And should there be new information, definitely the public, the media, and everyone else will be definitely be informed. We use these platforms to make sure that we share this information to the public at large and to everyone that we know that to, because it's a public interest case.
All right. Josephine Nitoamata, thank you so much for educating us on this and making time on the Reader News Bulletin.
Thank you so much, ma'am.
Okay. And you are tuned into On the Reader News Bulletin. We're just getting started with our news. So we pause here now, take a trip to the marketplace, and we'll be back with yet more news. Remember, you can also be part of the news bulletin. All you have to do is dial the studio number 083-288-401 to air your opinions and contributions.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lodrides at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Audio mnangeshefa ni wahara kushivifa oma akuro yo kupitira mohorike radio station yo Eagle FM. Enya mkuro olongaha. Ningi kwa tafano na Monica kushikondosho ipindi konorahe tatu imwe, heari imwe, ne heari, imwe imwe no hamano. That is 0817147116. Mwamberewa konorahe tatu natu, mbali ohe tatu vatatu, ne nola no natu. Ninge tumo emaila ku monica@eaglefm.com.na. Opo umone oshijemo shiri nawa.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. A group of concerned nursing graduates have submitted a petition to the Parliament of Namibia addressing critical issues related to the Health Professions Council of Namibia, also known as HPCNA. The petition specifically raises concerns around registration processes, internship placements, and professional recognition. According to the petitioners, these issues present systemic challenges that are preventing qualified graduates from entering the workforce. The petition further proposes urgent reforms, which they argue will not only benefit nursing graduates, but also contribute positively to the overall health sector in Namibia. In an effort to better understand the concerns raised, Eagle FM reached out to the representative for the nursing graduates, Zakaria Lazarus, who shared more details about the group's grievances and the motivation behind the petition. Good afternoon, Zakaria Lazarus, and welcome to On the Radar News Bulletin.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
I understand that the nursing, you as a representative for nursing graduates, you have written a petition to the National Assembly addressing certain issues in regards to the Health Profession Council of Namibia. Can you kindly walk us through what are those situations or what are those particular things that you guys are concerned about that you want them to be looked into?
Okay, maybe before I dive into what we want the Nursing Council to improve on or to look at their re-look at their policies, I would like to give you the background of how nursing has been.
Sure, go ahead.
Usually when the nursing graduates, when the nursing has graduated or the nurses students have graduated, before graduation, they should have registered already with the council. So now the Nursing Council have implemented a new policy whereby nursing students have to graduate first, and then that's when they will be called in to write the evaluation test, and that's when they can register now to become registered nurses.
Yeah.
So this now is causing delays. This registration is now a whole delaying process because it is concerning that after completing the studies in around November, let me say you are completing in November, and then now the next year, you are going to write the evaluation test around June or even later than that. So it's causing delays in nursing graduates. It's delaying, it's causing unemployment and prolonging the process also for unemployment. And it's really bringing frustration to the students now.
Of course.
So, it's bringing frustration to say this evaluation test that came up, it's supposed even maybe to be done around January or February, not to wait graduation around April, and that's when the students have to write the evaluation test, and then after passing that evaluation test, that's when you are considered fit to register to become a registered nurse or enrolled nurse, to register with the HPCNA.
Yeah.
So also looking at the evaluation test, what is included in the petition is that The fees for the evaluation test is too high. It's too costly. Because the parents have been paying already the institutions, and now parents are forced to pay the evaluation test fees, which is very high.
Okay, can you give us a figure of roughly how much it is the evaluation test?
To to apply for the evaluation test, you should pay 580. So you have to pay 580 to apply for the evaluation test. And then when you are called in to go and write the evaluation test, then you have to pay 2,170. So the 580 application fee covers two attempts. The first attempt, if you write the test, is you pay 2,170, and then if you fail, then it increased to 2,890.
Mm. Okay.
Yes. So when you keep failing now, it's again increasing. So it increases, and then it keeps increasing as you fail. So that's what is happening.
Okay. And another thing also that I've come across in your petition document is that this evaluation test can only be done in Windhoek. Even for those nursing graduates who are from other regions, they have to travel all the way to Windhoek to actually come and write the test. Is that so?
Yeah, that's so. So the accessibility and examination venues, currently the examination is only administered in Windhoek. This places an enormous financial burden on candidates from distant regions such as Katima Mulilo, who must travel over 1,000 kilometers and also pay for accommodation, transportation, and food. So the PCNA should really consider decentralizing the exam venues by allowing at least it to be written at regional or district hospitals, or even at the nursing schools near district hospitals. Yeah, so maybe this would reduce the financial strain and make the process more equitable.
Mm. Lazarus, your petition also speaks about Wilwitschia University having announced on their Facebook page that HPCNA has withdrawn the directive on 13 December 2024 that is limiting nursing students' intake to 50 per institution. Kindly also explain this further.
Yeah, that was a directive from Nursing Council. That's why it was included in the petition by all the nursing students from Wilwitschia. So Nursing Council came up with a directive that the industry or the nursing industry is congested, so they wanted the nation to receive quality nurses.
Yeah.
And maybe they've seen that this is too much congestion in the industry of having two intakes and all that. Then they came up with a directive of 15 student nurses per intake. 50 student nurses per intake and only one intake per year per institution. But they failed to keep their directive. So because there are still institutions that have taken more than those intakes. So that's what has been happening. And that's the directive that they have given, but they failed to keep that directive.
How did this disadvantage them? Because also in your petition, you speak about how students had from Wilwitschia University went to HPCNA to register, but they were not permitted to. And then you speak about also that the institution was the one to be penalized and not the students. Can you just make that clear?
Yeah, according to students from the Wilwitschia institution, it's like they were registered. They were registered in their first year to practice as student nurses. They paid the fee that is required for student nurses to pay so that they get their registration certificate to practice or to touch patients. So upon their training, they did not receive their certificate. And then upon completion, it's when they were told by the institution that they should go to the nursing council to register. Their names have been sent there. To their surprise, their names were not at the nursing council registered as students. So that could not allow them to go ahead to register as registered nurses and other positions and other qualifications because they were not registered as students. So they cannot go ahead to say they should register as registered nurses now. So that failure is now between either Wilwitschia and Nursing Council. Nobody knows who didn't do what or who didn't do their job so that they get the students registered. All that is known is that the students have paid and filled the forms to be registered as student nurses to be practicing during their training.
Mm, okay.
It has really disadvantaged the students because up to now those students, some of them were made to write the evaluation test. They failed for the first attempt, second attempt, and now they are required to write the test for the third.
Taking flight has never been easier. Paratus is introducing SkyFi internet packages with speeds that will have you reaching for your seatbelt. Starting from $500, excluding VAT, per month, with speeds reaching up to 10 megabits per second. There's even a prepaid option where you can top up your SkyFi internet for just $15 per gigabyte. No contracts, no fuss. Visit your nearest Paratus branch to find out more. Or go to paratus.africa/Namibia to sign up online. Always prepare, Paratus.
Now, overcrowded clinical placements and reduced quality of training that you've also spoken about, kindly also make it clear for on this regard.
Yeah, that was Nursing Council directive, that they feel they have to reduce the number of the intakes because the nursing industry is congested and maybe there's no time. And for the nurses also at the settings, they don't have enough time to give attention to all the students because the wards are full of students and all that. So that's why maybe it was a good idea to come up with the reduction of the number so that they have 50 students per intake. It was really good. It was a good thing, but they didn't keep up with their directive.
So now, what is it that you and your fellow nursing graduates that are in this matter are seeking? What specific things do you want the National Assembly to look into, or what are those particular things that you want HPCNA to relook?
Okay. Me and my fellows, we would like the National Assembly to look into the following. So we would like to have at least the accessibility and examination, or the accessibility of the evaluation test to all the regions. It should be decentralized for at least everyone, for it to be affordable to all the students. We would like the National Assembly to look at the fees. It's either they reduce the fees or they completely do away with the fees at least, because student nurses, when they go for allocations, they are not paid. Like, let me say doctor interns, pharmacist interns, they are being paid while they are on practice or internship. But nurses, they are not paid. Although they used to do that long years back ago, they used to pay the nurses while they are training. But it's no more done. So they should completely do away with the fees. And the percentage that is being required for one to pass that evaluation test is 65% per module, which is very high. They cannot be requiring 65%. While the institutions that they have approved, they make students to pass on 50%. 50% is the requirement to pass any module at an institution that is approved by HPCNA. But now they are requiring students to pass with 65%, which is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to reduce at least the percentage to 50% to align or to standardize with the institutions that they have themselves approved.
Mm.
Also, the regulation of the nursing institutions here, we would like the HPCNA to be regulating its institutions, because this looks like it's a failure that the Nursing Council is not doing its work to put up strict measures towards the institutions while the students are being trained. At least they should put up strict measures towards the institutions so that students undergo a training that is being monitored by them, so that they avoid coming to make students pay or to evaluate them at the end of their training. Because students have gone through a training through an institution that was approved by the HPCNA. Why are you doubting the institution that you yourself have approved? So that is our concern.
Okay. So one of the things that you're actually looking into is that HPCNA does away with the evaluation test. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. It's possible it should be done away with it, and then they should put up strict measures.
Okay.
Towards the training of the students.
Okay. Nazare Zakaria, I sure hope that your petition gets onto the right ears and gets solved within a reasonable time frame, and that you, as nursing students, get satisfied with the answer.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. And now we take a trip to the marketplace, but we'll be back shortly with more news. Stay tuned.
Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards, and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Audio mnangeshefa no hara kushivifa oma kuroye kupitira mohorike radio station ayo Eagle FM. Enyamukuru olongaha. Ningekwata fano na Monica kushikondosha ipindi konorahita tuimwe heari imwe ne heari imwe imwe no hamano. That is 0817147116. Mamberewa konorahita tu natu bali o hetatu vatatu ne nola no natu. Ninge tumo emaila ku monica@eaglefm.com.na. Opomone oshijemo shiri nawa.
Eagle FM, the eye.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. You are tuned in to On the Radar News Bulletin right here on Eagle FM. And now for some breaking news. President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah has appointed former presidential advisor Inge Zamani Kamwe as Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, replacing Mark Hengari.
I have to withdraw one member of my nominee, whom I have nominated to the National Assembly, and also in forming of the cabinet, having been appointed the person as one of my ministers or the ministers of the Namibian government. I have therefore decided on the power that is invested to me by the Namibian Constitution that I replaced my withdrawal with another distinguished Namibian, a person who has proved herself over the years during the liberation struggle and an independent Namibia, a person I can call a child of the struggle, who has grown in the hands of our leaders, including our founding president, as well
to fill the position in the National Assembly, which a process that was concluded this morning. I now have the honor to inform that the same person I decided to appoint her as Namibia's Minister of Agriculture, Fishery, Water, and Land Management. And that's why.
And there you had the announcement from the president herself. With that being said, a short commercial break, and we'll be back with yet more news. Stay tuned.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Welcome back. The government of Namibia is set to borrow a total of 29.8 billion Namibian dollars during the 2025-2026 financial year. Now, that is to help meet its budgetary obligations. This according to the finalized annual borrowing plan released by the Bank of Namibia on behalf of the government. Of the total amount, 21.2 billion is expected to be sourced from domestic financial market, while the remainder will be raised through external borrowing mechanisms. The borrowing plan forms part of the government's broader strategy to finance the national budget, to address debt servicing obligations and fund ongoing developmental programs. Now, to help break this down further, let's engage junior economist Peter Franz. Good afternoon, Peter Franz, and welcome to On the Radar News Bulletin.
Good afternoon, Abby. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, indeed. Pleasure is all mine. Now, with the government intended to borrow 29.8 billion Namibian dollars during this year's financial year of 2025-2026, kindly tell us, as an economist, why does the government need to borrow this much amount of money, and what could be the long-term and short-term effects of this?
So if you remember correctly at the beginning of the year when we started, I think I said somewhere where I stated that with a deficit balance, it's funded by the debt. So this borrowing is brought by this deficit budget that we have in the country. So basically, this is mainly the main problem. And secondly, I'm just hoping the government is not borrowing this kind of money to source administration salaries or such.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, so the long-term effect of this borrowing, it's a result in the fact that the government will be in debt, given that we already have other commitments that we are paying, such as 8.6 billion, that now we also have to source from other external sources, as is stated in the article. So the short-term effect could be that we are resolving the current situation that the government is going through.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the long run, this when you have to pay back, it's going to be a problem because it's now adding on the loan that already exists from African Bank, from the property financing and other bodies.
Yeah. Now, according to the borrowing plan, the national budget tabled at the end of March this year has a funding shortage or shortfall of $12.8 billion already. That's representing a fiscal deficit equivalent to 4.6% of the country's gross domestic product. Now, just how reasonable can we actually attach to what the government is doing to borrow this such high amount of money?
So when there's a deficit in a budget, that simply means if it remains like that, that simply means the budget is going to be short in one of the projects that they intend to go do in future.
Mm-hmm.
So they are just trying to avoid with the fact that they cannot have such a huge gap, which is a deficit now. So this is basically why they are borrowing such a huge amount, just to finance this deficit. Otherwise, it's also going to hinder with the government's operations.
Correct. Now, 21.2 billion Namibian dollars is expected or planned to be sourced locally. Just how do you suggest or how or what terms do you think the government will go about that to source this 21.2 billion Namibian dollars?
Yes, so mostly they make use of the government bonds, and also sometimes they just say it's because they are borrowing in the national currency, in the Namibian currency. They could take the money from elsewhere, but these kind of funds, they will be in the Namibian dollars. So that's why they are saying it's a domestic loan. However, it's just because it's of the currency. So sometimes when you borrow, let's say from the African bank, you borrow in the US dollars. But this time around, wherever they are going to source the money from, it will be in our currency. So it bring a benefit of where the currency fluctuates. In that case, it's a benefit to us wherever we are going to source these funds.
Mm-hmm. Now, compared to the previous financial year, domestic borrowing required 15 billion Namibian dollars, and the 2025-2026 target represents an increase of more than 6 billion Namibian dollars. Now, continuing in future, what would you say government should do in order to reduce its continuous borrowing and rather also be looking within locally and perhaps maybe a little bit of squeezing of budgets, although obviously that is not something that might be possible in the near future.
So, Hebi, the current budget, it's not a budget issue. So right now we are sitting with the agricultural products that don't have a market in this country. And we all know, and it's evident that it's agriculture that will take this country to another level. If we can get a market for these products, that means the inflation will be very low and also will consume locally. So for me, I think if we can just give subsidies to the guys that are participating in this, in the agriculture industry, it will solve a lot of government problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I agree. But is it only agriculture that we should put our eyes on, or perhaps other sectors as well that we can actually generate money from? I mean, at the end of the day, we need to be sufficient and rely on ourselves. Just yesterday, we covered news on Donald Trump sort of planning to slash $555 billion meant for Africa development.
Yes, yes. I think the manufacturing industry as well, that comes to mining. I think Ministry of Trade has also some measures in place, such as growth at home. That's where when you extract mineral resources, we don't export them as raw as they are. However, but we need to clean them. We need to polish them here, and also if where possible, we need to cut them at least to turn them into semi-finished products. I think that would also be of benefit to the country.
Value addition.
Yes, value addition.
We go a lot about talking about value addition, but is there really much being done? And while we are still on this, on value addition, who actually should be, of course, the government can keep on saying that we need to do value addition to the products that we do manage or produce here in Namibia. But who exactly at the core, and how do you think we should go about it if we're going to better the economy of Namibia, France?
So we are not talking about the technical know-how, the people, the expertise, people that know how to do those things. And I think at this point, the government haven't actually put into place people that can be trained to do such work, or bringing some foreign people that can do the work at a minimum employment, and also maybe just put a lot of Namibian people in place as well to gain that on-job training for that particular job. So, yeah, it was just implemented, but I don't think the initiatives were actually taken into considerations yet.
Okay. Now, lastly, Franz, on this particular topic, as an economist, let me give you the platform to actually speak furthermore on what you suggest, or what is it that you plan, or what is it that you expect to see in the near future when we talk about financial year and borrowing for the Namibian government.
Yes, it's actually something very interesting that you are talking about this, considering the fact that you also have the free education, the tertiary free education that is coming. So if the government is borrowing this early, what about next year when the education is actually free? Where are they going to source the funds from to finance these kind of institutions that were on budget and also getting money from students when they are registering tuition fees and other sources? So where is the government going to get the money from if they are borrowing already to fund the deficit? It's concerning. However, I think it's also a thing of maybe just grabbing popcorns and then you watch what's going to happen. You just have to trust the process, I guess.
Franz, Peter Franz, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Radio News Bulletin. Indeed, we will sit back, eat some popcorns and also play our part for those who have businesses to do value addition to our own manufacturing of stuff right here in Namibia. But thank you so much for making time for us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Okay. And there you had it from economist Peter Franz, just shedding his wisdom in light of the government intended to borrow 29.8 billion Namibian dollars during the 2025-2026 financial year. And now we pause here again for a short commercial break and we'll be back with economic indicators.
Zakale iferire mise kunani zencha kuzwa kwa kushimba lifera zalivuka kuya kwa ifasi na lifera fama kepe muvone maikuto amancha a inga ep mwikute kulibusi emba santo yenye tuna mwikole sfera fama kepe marizo hola mina amuvone imba encha ni encha falizwe ikopi ya mifuta ya lifera matasa ep ilimi kukopanya naha ni kuhasa nyali zira mlimu Zengi, zefu mani hamasifera sesifa app ya imba, ze tatama Elsin, Ehangano, Oshiherero, Omaemuriro, Catholic, Simani Kakarunga, Africans, ni zengi zengata. Muluri zeze kachenu, haiva mtavira kulisifera sa kireke ya mina, si eke zuefa mkoloko walifera za imba, fa 081-235-8063. Kapa mulumere imele kwa digital@omalighty.com. Muzive ni kufumana imba kachenu. Mukona kuifumana fa App Store ni Google Play Store.
Did you know that in Namibia over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
Welcome back. And now before we actually take you to economic indicators, the Ministry of Mines and Energy has announced that the fuel prices for May will remain unchanged. The ministry noted that there were over-recoveries of 13.36 cents per litre for petrol and $17.39 per litre for 50 ppm diesel and over-recoveries of $25.83 per litre for 10 ppm diesel. And with that being said, the fuel prices will remain unchanged for the month of May. And now for some economic indicators. On agricultural commodities, the top commodity gainers are cotton at 4.82%, cocoa coming in at 3.33%, and corn at 1.36%. The biggest losers are oat at minus 2.36% and sugar at 0.90%. On metal commodities, the top commodity losers are copper at minus 1.06%, iron ore at minus 1.05%, and gold at minus 0.45%. Gains are led by steel rebar at 0.62%. Energy commodities, the top commodity gainers are natural gas at 3.25%, crude oil WTI at 1.62%, and blend crude oil at 1.41%, with the biggest losers being natural gas EU Dutch at 0.67%. Foreign exchange reserves held by the People's Bank of China rose by an equivalent of $41 billion from the previous month to 3,241 trillion US dollars in April of 2025, the highest level since September of 2024. Now, the increase took place despite the plunge in the dollar in the period. In 10, gold reserves rose by an equivalent 13.9 billion US dollars to 244 billion US dollars, aligned with the appreciation of bullion prices in the year. France posted a current account surplus of 1.4 billion euro in March 2025, shifting from a downwardly revised 1.6 billion euro deficit in the previous month. This marked the first current account surplus since December 2024, as goods account shortfall narrowed to 4.3 billion euros from 6.2 billion euros in February 2025. In addition, services account surplus widened to 5.3 billion euros in March 2025, that is from 4.2 billion euro dollars in the previous month. Meanwhile, primary income surplus slightly decreased to 4.2 billion euros in March 2025 from 4.3 billion euros in the prior month, with the secondary income deficit remained unchanged at 3.9 billion euros. Now, Namibia Stock Exchange primary list, the Capricorn Group comes in at 16.96% for year one, with a, and the first rand at minus 3.84%. Lesotho Namibia comes in at 32.26%, and Namibian Asset Man at 1.39%. SBN Holdings standing at 21.53%. While stimulus investment is at 0.00%, Alpha Namibia 0.0%, MTC at 6.87%, Namibian Breweries at a negative 3.57%, while Nictus Holding is at 30.63%, and Oryx Properties is at 11.12%, and Paratus Namibia at 5.42%. Now, that's what we had for you today on trading economics that are trading today. With that being said, we pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. But when we do return, we'll be bringing you news beyond the borders. Stay tuned.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.2.
Ninge kwa tafano na Monica kushikondosho ipindi konora hitatu imwe, heari imwe, ne heari, imwe imwe, no hamano. That is 0817147116. Mamberewa konora hitatu natu, mbali o hitatu vatatu, ne nola no natu. Ninge tumo emaila ku monica@eaglefm.com.na. Opo mwane oshijemo shiri nawa.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, Between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards, and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
Welcome back, and I will take you to news beyond the borders. Of course, we start off regionally, then we move over to continental news, thereafter international news. Meanwhile, in South Africa, in Cape Town, an anti-corruption conference is being held on artificial intelligence on ways to fight corruption.
A warm welcome again here at the West Inn Hotel for this 15th Commonwealth Regional Conference on the heads of the anti-corruption units. Of course, they are discussing issues around fighting corruption, holding those accountable, as well as recovering any monies that have been lost by the state. And of course, today's theme is going to be about the progress on the establishment of the International Anti-Corruption Court. Of course, I'm going to bring into this conversation now Dr. Roger Korantenge, who is the head of public sector governance at the Commonwealth Secretariat in the UK. Dr. Korantenge, firstly, thank you so much for your time. Let's start on this theme of today around the establishment of this International Anti-Corruption Court, the genesis of that idea.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm coming from the Commonwealth in UK. We thought the anti-corruption is an issue that affects particularly the poorest of the poor. So it's something that is affecting all of us, and we have to be find ways and means of dealing with it. Yeah, the International Anti-Corruption Court, I must say it was the idea of Justice Goldman. I'm sure you're going to interview him. My role is to bring everybody together, because when I got into the Commonwealth Secretariat, there was nothing like anti-corruption work being done. So I have this idea, converted into a vision, and I've worked on it for the past 15 years. So I bring all these people together in various countries. We have been into Mauritius, the Seychelles, we're in Ghana last year, and this year we are in Cape Town. The International Court is a very important court, because we don't have a way of dealing with politically exposed people in corruption. The corruption are being done by the most powerful people in the society, and our domestic court across member countries are not able to deal with them. So that's why we need to have something like International Court for corruption proper, because I realize that everybody in the world talk about corruption because it affects all of us.
The challenge again with these international bodies, as much as they are a noble idea, but would they be able to have teeth, given that, as you've said, that we're talking about now people who are in powerful positions? And again, in some other parallel structures, like in human rights, we have some heads of states who've got international warrants of arrest against them, but I mean, they can travel freely.
Yeah.
How are you going to ensure that this International Anti-Corruption Court has teeth at least?
You see, that's a challenge. That's why you need to have a consensus around the world, because unless all of us agree, it's not going to work. We need to bring everybody, the developing and every country in between, to be part of this, because it's corruption is a crime against humanity, because you are taking collective resources into somebody's pocket or private pocket and denying people their livelihood, their education, health. And so it's so important that we have to deal with it across. But the challenge, as we all know, and that's what we're going to discuss here, how do we get everybody to be on board? Because it's not going to be easy, I must say. Particularly with the global changes in US and everybody else, it's becoming very, very, very difficult. But it's also called to attention that this is the more reason why we should come together to fight this menace. Because if we don't, then that means that we're going to lose out on a large segment of the population, because they're not going to be able to do anything because they've been deprived. So that is why this particular topic is so important for us this time around. We are
still in South Africa. Experts gather to debate energy future at GES Symposium.
Johannesburg, this university is hosting its annual GAS Symposium, drawing energy experts, industry leaders and government officials to discuss the role of gas in South Africa's energy mix. This gathering focuses on critical issues such as energy security, economic growth and sustainability as the country looks to diversify its energy mix with more clean and reliable options. Let's get your sense of what else we know. Bring in SABC News economics editor Tipo Mwai, who's live to us now from Parktown in Johannesburg. And Tipo, this comes at a time when many people have spoken about a gas cliff that South Africa is facing, speaking to how, you know, our gas reserves in some instances may significantly decline in the next couple of years.
Absolutely, and good morning. Of course, the issue of a gas cliff is one that has actually received a spotlight here at the Vets Business School Gas Natural Gas Symposium. You would know that for the longest time in South Africa, we've been dependent on one source of natural gas under Sasol, sourced from Mozambique. And of course, we know that that particular source is now being depleted, and Sasol has actually announced that in the next few years, in fact, 2026, you know, industrial users must actually find alternative source. So this is what anchors discussions here, where people, different stakeholders are gathering here to explore various avenues that will ensure that we avoid the so-called gas cliff. For more on this, I'm now joined by Priscilla Mabelani. She is the Vets Business School Advisory Board member and chairperson, and she's also a former vice president of energy at Sasol Petrochemical Giant. Thank you very much for joining us at this very important discussions for the country. Just tell us, how did we get to this point where we are facing a natural gas cliff?
Okay, thank you. Good morning, listeners, and to you, Tapo, as well, and thanks for the opportunity. Let me try and answer your question in the positive. We are where we are. The key element of today at the Vets Business School that we are looking at is taking the lessons learned and particularly reflecting on where we are. What will it take for us to accelerate the access and security of gas supply in the country, and at the same time to make sure that we can actually drive other sectors and applications that will depend on gas. For me, earlier on, I mentioned that we should look at this not necessarily as only a security of supply issue, but as an opportunity to drive economic stimulation, create jobs, and to be able to ensure that we can transform and transition as a country. So at the back of that, for me, there are three key elements that needs to be addressed. First of all, you've already mentioned that the dependency on one source of supply has been an issue of challenge. So we have regional integration, but at the same time, we also have ports that provides us opportunity in the medium term to be able to accelerate the diversification of our supply. So we do believe that putting in the policies that enable infrastructure development, particularly Transnet, I'm encouraged by the role that they're leading now and driving the development of Richards Bay as a priority port. So that is quite critical. So that diversification strategy is one element that needs to be unlocked. The second element that is much more critical is how do we ensure that as other sectors are going to reduce their demand for LNG, because they can't afford it. As we know, it is actually driven by global dynamics, but also it is going to be dollar-based. So LNG is not affordable for certain sectors, so we expect that the demand is going to reduce. We've already had Sasol mentioning that they will not afford LNG in their operations. So we need another source to be able to anchor to make sure we've got the scale required to anchor an LNG terminal. The minister earlier on spoke about the ability to be able to bring substantial LNG into the country through one of our terminals, which is LNG, which is Richards Bay, and that will require a minimum of 80 to 100 petajoules that we need to bring in. So the power to gas is also important to anchor the LNG demand. And I think
Meanwhile, in Zambia, President Hakainde Hichilema calls for technology investment in climate research centers.
Zambia has hosted the International Conference on Climate Resilience and Adaptation, CLEAR 2025, meant to advance climate adaptation and resilience. The conference also seeks to offer innovative and sustainable solutions to key economic sectors such as agriculture and energy through robust research. And President Hakainde Hichilema, in a speech delivered on his behalf by Green Economy and Environment Minister Mike Mbusha, called for more investment in research centers at public universities.
We do not want to just talk about evidence. We want to see pathways for investments in increasing capacity for Southern leadership on climate change, evidence to action.
University of Zambia owns a Vice Chancellor, Professor Mundia Moya, added that stakeholder collaboration is key.
We affirm that our reality is not our destiny. Through collaboration, innovation, and the exchange of knowledge, we have the power to turn vulnerability into resilience and challenges into opportunities for sustainable growth.
And Lusaka Mayor Chilando Chitangala emphasized more on engaging communities.
What sets Lusaka apart is the determination of its people from the community groups mobilizing to clear clogged drainages. We work as a local authority, we work with people in the communities so that we can clear the drainages in our city.
The Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, FCDO, Head of Climate Science and Adaptation Research, Rosalind West, highlighted that research and innovation will explore efforts in action.
From the outset, the vision for this CLEAR programme has been to enable needs-driven, action-orientated research through which transdisciplinary partnerships co-create effective solutions to the climate crisis for the most vulnerable. We have been deeply impressed by how you have risen to this challenge.
And British High Commissioner to Zambia, Rebecca Tezion, reaffirmed the commitment of the United Kingdom to investing in research and innovation.
Through action-oriented research programmes like CLARE, we can make real impact, improving lives for millions. And this week is crucial for achieving that impact.
Karen Mwaka, ZMBC News, Lusaka.
Meanwhile, Ghana trials a sustainable farming method to boost yam yields.
At this market in Accra, yams, one of the most widely consumed tubers in Ghana, are in short supply. Prices for what is available have rocketed. This is due to factors including declining soil fertility and shortage of plant support stakes. Traditionally, farmers cut down trees to use as support for the yam vines. Over time, clearing new fields and making more stakes results in deforestation and increased production costs.
Prices of yam is expensive, and consumers can't withstand the price. Buying 100 pieces of yam is not easy to reckon with. Where the yams are grown in Ghana is very far from the capital, Accra. The fuel alone used for transporting yam is also not a joke.
Scientists are now introducing a new yam growing method that boosts yields and eliminates the need for stakes. They're using plants such as pigeon pea and bitter damsel as live stakes. This method can also improve the soil and bring other benefits to farmers.
You grow yam from the edible tuber. That has been the norm, growing yam from the edible tuber. So it's also put a lot of demand on the yam. And yam prices go high during the planting season because the tuber that you eat is the same tuber that we are going to use as seed. So from our technology, we were looking at high ratio multiplication techniques to ensure increased numbers of the seed yam for the farmer to use in the seed in the yam production.
Additionally, the scientists also look to improve the quality of yam seeds.
As part of our research, we've worked extensively to ensure that we have full sustainability when it comes to yam. With yam production, seed is a critical factor. And the seed, having access to quality seed, can take up to between 60 and 70% of the production cost. In line with our research, we focused on ensuring quality seed.
And many are happy to embrace these improved methods. If the innovation has come, it's a laudable move that more than 10 tubers of yam can be uprooted from a single hole. And this is quite amazing for us, who are used to buying and selling it here. Ghana is the world's largest yam exporter. And with increasing demands for yam in the country and abroad, scientists hope to not only create added value, but also business for the country's yam farmers. Sophia Shimechero, CGTN.
Morocco's capital, Rabat, expands the luxury tourism sector.
The Four Seasons Hotel in Rabat is one of a host of new grand properties in the capital. It was a former palace in the 18th century and then a military hospital in the early 1900s. The hotel boasts an architectural design that reflects Moroccan heritage, such as carefully carved wooden ceilings.
Because we are very proud of the history of the place, from the Sultan to the military hospital, the team is all aware of what it used to be and share the history of the place with all the guests checking in, and especially with the clientele coming at leisure. We're very interested to know what happened in the place. One of our rooms, you can actually sleep where the Sultan used to sleep.
About 23 kilometers from Rabat, the Conrad Rabat Azana Hotel overlooks the Atlantic Ocean. Some of its rooms are fitted with private pools on the balconies. The hotel's restaurant serves a selection of dishes, including Asian cuisine, to cater to their many guests from Asia.
What we saw recently really increasing is, for example, the Chinese market or the Asian market. In particular, Taiwan, for example, there's the tour operators, and they show a great interest to Morocco, looking for new destinations, something new that a lot of people are actually looking at now.
With the luxury hotels reaping the benefits from foreign travelers, they are increasingly focusing on personalized experiences. They combine local and international dishes, provide spa and wellness services, and host boutique shops that sell a selection of traditional fashion and accessories.
We have approximately 10 luxury hotels, all of them international brands. The goal is to attract the largest number of international tourists. There are also approximately 5 luxury hotel projects currently under construction.
According to tourism officials, visitors to the luxury hotels also want to discover Rabat through its history, explore the country's beaches and culture. Morocco relies on tourism for about 7% of its GDP. It is now working to enhance global competitiveness and attract new markets. Caroline B., CGTN.
Egyptian businesses feel the impact of Sudanese refugees' exit.
Mohamed Al-Ghul is a real estate broker who rents houses in Giza City to Sudanese refugees fleeing the civil war. He says their influx has revitalized Egypt's real estate market.
Before their arrival, the average rental was 2 to 3,000 Egyptian pounds a month. Now the average is from 8,000 to 14,000 Egyptian pounds in this area. In Giza alone, there are about 500,000 Sudanese. The demand was so high and it was affordable to them because in many cases, 3 or 4 Sudanese families paid good money to share one big furnished apartment together.
But as security gradually improves in Sudan, over 155,000 people have returned to their country recently, while more are on the way. Al-Ghul says their absence will be felt.
Definitely, they were a source of income for a lot of us, whether as brokers or apartment owners or even shops and stores that saw demand soar for their products when the Sudanese arrived. Now we are beginning to see a slowdown in sales and rentals.
There are about 9 million refugees in Egypt, but no refugee camps. They are allowed to mix in the community and have several rights, like Egyptians, in health, education services, and even the right to own property and establish businesses. Many have made good use of this opportunity, such as Soaid Shagiri, who trains Sudanese women to open small businesses in Egypt.
We provide vocational training, especially for Sudanese women, to teach them to design Sudanese-inspired accessories, colorful costumes, different dresses, and other products. We also empower poor families to establish small businesses through technical and financial support.
Syrian, Yemeni, and Iraqi refugees opening businesses in Egypt are also contributing to the local economy. This includes Ayat Faisal, who has been in Egypt for just over a year now.
I established a small market along with several traders to sell Sudanese women accessories that I design and manufacture myself. We wouldn't have done this without the support of the Egyptian state and the people who embraced us and are very kind and helpful.
She even hires Egyptians in her small shop.
Egypt has always hosted its brothers and sisters from other countries in tough times. In return, some of them set up projects and create jobs for Egyptians like myself, helping to solve the unemployment problem. I enjoy working with the Sudanese. They are honest and kind people.
As thousands of Sudanese prepare to return, many are interested in maintaining their presence in Egypt.
We are planning to go back home, but we decided to keep the business here open and expand it further, because there is big potential in the Egyptian market.
Although the Egyptian government has highlighted the financial burden of maintaining 9 million migrants and refugees from Arab and African countries, their positive impact in several sectors is evident. Yas Hakim for CGTN, Cairo, Egypt.
Film confronts the liberal palsy myths in Sierra Leone and Africa.
This is Fatmata Ba's grandchild, one of many children with cerebral palsy around the world. The 12-year-old was abandoned by his father when he was diagnosed with the illness at only 3 months old.
It's because of him that we were told to leave the house where we first lived. They said they couldn't live with him for fear that their children might catch his illness. They said water drips from his mouth and their children touch it. I told them that if his illness were transferable, we would have been the first to get it.
This is the discrimination that many children and families are facing.
For many parents and caregivers like Fatmata, it takes courage to continue caring for children with cerebral palsy, as each day brings its own set of challenges.
The new movie, Spellbound, is looking to open the door to compassion and understanding.
What society needs to do is to empathize and put ourselves in the shoes of those parents who are struggling to take care of their children with cerebral palsy. We shouldn't call them the children of the devil or use any name that reminds the parents of her misfortune, as some parents actually lose their homes.
Kenyan actor Majid Michelle told CGTN that the media is a powerful tool to addressing social issues like cerebral palsy.
And when I read the script, I'm like, oh my goodness, growing up, I knew children with cerebral palsy. And finally, a producer has found a cause to make a film concerning cerebral palsy. And the producer is not just doing this film because it was a great story. The producers actually work with children with cerebral palsy in real life.
Medical experts say children with cerebral palsy need consistent physical and speech therapy to improve their quality of life.
So cerebral palsy is a multifactorial disorder that affects the muscle tone and the movement. So it's a movement disorder that is multifactorial, so there are many causes. Many things come together to cause it, but it is usually idiopathic because you cannot identify a sole cause. It can occur during pregnancy or during the birthing process or just after the birthing process.
The film hopes to shift both local and global discourse on cerebral palsy and engender more understanding for families who are dealing with the illness. Eric Kawa reporting for CGTN in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Chinese apparel designers embrace live streaming to reach African consumers.
Just a few years ago, Ka Shinha's boutique fashion label was struggling. Wholesale orders had slowed. Rent for his small showroom was draining his budget. And he worried his fashion designs might never find their audience. Then he tried something radical, turned on a phone camera and started talking.
The competitive nature of live streaming means sellers like Ka Shinha must continuously find new ways to engage his customers.
Today, Ka Shinha isn't just surviving, he's thriving, thanks to the live streaming boom that is reshaping retail in China. His customer base has widened, with many of his customers based in Asia.
Well, our main target group is still in Asia with a few domestic clients. Then there's a small number of Korean customers, Japanese customers, and markets in Hong Kong and Taiwan.
Shinha's sales have increased substantially, but the real win, he says, is the connection. Regulars chat about tailoring requests. Others share photos of themselves wearing his designs. Yu Chao, a live streamer, says live streaming has completely transformed the business.
If it's live, it's more efficient. For example, if I come to the store, I may only be able to sell on a one-on-one basis. But if I go online, I can sell to multiple customers and the turnover rate will be higher.
Shinha's next goal is to expand beyond Asia. With platforms like TikTok Shop testing cross-border live streams, his dream is to someday introduce his designs to Africa. Daniel Arab Moy, CGTN, Hiwu, China.
India attacks on Pakistan as tension boils.
The death toll is rising from Indian military strikes on Pakistan, raising fears that two nuclear-armed rivals are moving closer to war. A Pakistani military spokesperson tells Reuters at least 26 civilians have been killed and 46 injured. India claims to have targeted terrorist infrastructure in several locations inside Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. India insists its missile strikes were, quote, focused and precise and designed to be non-escalatory in nature. But Pakistan rejects that claim. Pakistan also says it shot down five Indian Air Force jets and a drone. CNN cannot independently confirm those claims. And this just in, according to a senior Indian defense source, Pakistani shelling in Indian-administered Kashmir has now killed eight people. These back-and-forth attacks come about 2 weeks after gunmen massacred 26 tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. India quickly accused Pakistan of supporting terrorists in the region. Pakistan denied any responsibility. The two sides have also been exchanging shelling and gunfire across their disputed border. This is the first time since 2019 that India has struck inside Pakistani territory. The attacks in Punjab province are the deepest since the 1971 war. And we want to go live now to CNN's Paula Hancock's following developments from Abu Dhabi. Good to see you, Paula. So what is the latest on these developments in the wake of India's military strikes on Pakistan?
Well, Rosemary, India says that it carried out these strikes in the early hours of Wednesday morning, starting at 1.05 a.m., and they say that they lasted 25 minutes. Now, from the Indian side, we are hearing that they made sure they did not target civilians or any economic or military infrastructure. From the Pakistan side, we are hearing that that simply wasn't the case. So, first of all, the statement from the Indian Defense Minister. They said, quote, our actions have been focused, measured and non-escalatory in nature. No Pakistani military facilities have been targeted. India has demonstrated considerable restraint in selection of targets and method of execution. But what we are hearing from the Pakistan side is that civilians and also mosques have been targeted. Officials saying that some six locations these strikes took place, and at least 26 were killed. They say civilians, including children, at least one as young as 3 years old, also saying that some 46 have been injured. Now, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has said that he considers this an act of war, saying that Pakistan has the right to give a befitting reply. Now, Pakistan also claims that it has shot down five jets and a drone of the Indian Air Force, also claiming that three of them are Rafale jets. This is a very sophisticated French-made jet, which is really a prized asset of the Indian Air Force. We have heard from the Indian military since those claims, but they have not engaged with those claims at all. CNN cannot confirm or deny that that is the case. And we are also hearing that there has been more cross-border fire from Pakistani-controlled Kashmir into the Indian-administered Kashmir this Wednesday morning as well, in retaliation to those strikes. Another eight have been killed in those. We understand on the Indian side of the administered disputed territory, there are evacuations taking place to more safe areas. It is of great concern that these two nuclear-powered countries are seeing this increased tension. Countries around the world, the US, China and the United Nations, calling both to show restraint.
India carrying out the deepest strike in Pakistan in more than 50 years. Video shared on social media shows the moment of impact from one of those strikes. India says it was targeting, quote, terrorist infrastructure in the wake of a tourist massacre in the disputed territory of Kashmir. Pakistan has denied any involvement in that. Now, Pakistan's military says India's strikes killed at least 26 civilians, including children. And security sources there say five Indian Air Force jets and drones were shot down during this attack. Now, Pakistan is vowing retaliation. This is a serious situation, one of the worst we've seen in the region in years. Let's get right to CNN's Nick Robertson, who's in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, for the very latest. Good morning, Nick.
Yeah, good morning, John, and good afternoon from here. It was Trump officials around about lunchtime today, just before lunchtime here, that Pakistan officials held a national security committee meeting. That's the top government officials along with the top security officials. The prime minister, following that, said that the Pakistan army was entitled to act in self-defense, he said, with, quote, corresponding actions. He also said that the Pakistani army should avenge the death of innocent civilians. Among the dead, government officials are saying, was a three-year-old girl. Among the damaged properties was a seminary. The head of that seminary is the leader of a group called Jaishi Mohammed, who actually claimed a terror attack inside Indian-controlled Kashmir in 2019. Back then, it was a suicide bomber killing 40 Indian security forces in that attack. That appears to have been the site of one of India's targets. India has not provided Pakistani officials, as far as we've been told, with evidence of the alleged involvement in that massacre of 26 civilians. Neither have they provided information about their allegations in this attack, that they say that they were preempting a terror attack. However, the leader of that seminary, the leader of Jaish-e-Mohammed, they're called, he says that 10 of his family members, including children, were killed in the strike. But his most recent Telegram posting was a threat against India. His organization has a track record of targeting India. So a lot to unpack. But the words of the prime minister after that security committee meeting are very...
Meanwhile, Trump officials are holding trade talks with China.
Trump officials will travel to Switzerland, we're now learning, later this week to hold trade talks with Chinese officials. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent confirmed the trip last night during an appearance on Fox News. It will be the first formal meeting between the two countries since President Trump raised tariffs on Chinese imports to 145% just over a month ago. Last night, Secretary Bessent downplayed the likelihood of any deal, though, being reached.
Look, we have shared interest that this isn't sustainable, as I said before, especially on the Chinese side. And, you know, 145%, 125% is the equivalent of an embargo. We don't want to decouple. What we want is fair trade. My sense is that this will be about de-escalation, not about the big trade deal. And but we've got to de-escalate before we can move forward.
Meanwhile, President Trump says the United States does not need to sign trade deals. That's what he told reporters yesterday at the White House after weeks of promising deals with dozens of countries.
We also have a situation because everyone says, when are you going to sign deals? We don't have to sign deals. We could sign 25 deals right now, Howard, if we wanted. We don't have to sign deals. They have to sign deals with us. They want a piece of our market. We don't want a piece of their market. We don't care about their market. They want a piece of our market. You keep writing about deals. When are we going to sign one? It's very simple. We're going to say, in some cases, we want you to open up your country. In some cases, we want you to drop your tariffs. They're going to pay for the privilege of being able to shop in the United States of America. It's very simple. So I wish they'd keep, stop asking, how many deals are you signing this week? Because one day we'll come and we'll give you 100 deals. And they don't have to sign. All they have to do is say, oh, we'll start sending our ships right now to pick up whatever we want or to bring whatever we want. It's very, very simple.
So Jonathan Lemire, as we've been talking about for several weeks now, the entire rationale for these tariffs coming from the president and the Trump administration was to negotiate deals. In other words, we're going to throw a 145% tariff on China to get them to the table so we can negotiate deals. He's saying you have to take this short-term pain, consumer. There will be inflation coming, consumer. You have to get only $2 and not $30, consumer, because we're getting ready to make these deals that will benefit you in the long run. So what is he talking about there yesterday in the Oval Office?
Well, on this conclave day, I'm definitely John the Third, or maybe John the Lesser, who knows.
Nice.
I'll certainly take a backseat to the others here. This is going to be more confusion and uncertainty. So a few things here. First of all, President Trump for days now has been saying that the U.S. government has been talking to the Chinese, beginning trade negotiations. None of that was true. He was contradicted day after day by his leading officials, including his Treasury Secretary, saying, no, that hadn't been the case. Bessent said yesterday morning, flat out, no, we haven't talked to the Chinese yet. Now there is this meeting set for this weekend in Switzerland. Now, it's a preliminary one. I don't think anyone anticipates a deal being struck that moment, but at least it's a step in the right direction. But you counter that with what we heard from the president yesterday in that Oval Office meeting as he sat alongside the Prime Minister of Canada, talking about, well, maybe we don't need deals. Our economy is so strong.
You
just played the sound. And all that's going to do is further roil markets, potentially, but also plant seeds of doubt among business leaders who don't know where to invest, who don't know what to do. Consumers' confidence, which you've already seen plunge, well, that stuff's not going to help. So I'm told that, yes, with a few countries, there has been some progress made, but relatively small steps. And China looms as the big one. And that Beijing has taken a tough stance to this point simply by meeting the U.S. with silence. So it's a step in the right direction, Mika, that they will have first meetings this weekend. But deals don't appear to be close. And certainly none have been done just yet. This period of uncertainty lives on as this pause that the president initiated a few weeks ago, the clock is ticking. What happens next?
Yeah, it is.
That remains an open question. No one seems to know.
Inside ETFs, a sector exposure is key when choosing a dividend fund.
Can dividend funds protect investors from stock market volatility? There are now more than 100 exchange-traded funds focused on dividend stocks, with around $500 billion invested in them. The majority of assets are concentrated in the biggest index funds, like Vanguard's Dividend Appreciation ETF, or VIG. It's probably well known in the past for having a focus on financials and tech stocks, but not all dividend funds have the same strategy. To find out more about these funds, I'm joined by Aniket Ullal. He's head of ETF research and analytics at CFRA Research. Aniket, is it fair to say these dividend funds are now a type of safe haven investment?
The short answer is yes, but I think the important information is in the details. In other words, I think that the way the ETFs are constructed and the way the underlying indices are constructed really matters. So if we take, for example, VIG, which you just mentioned, it has a lower yield because it focuses much more on stocks that pay regular dividend as opposed to focusing just on high yield dividend stocks. Whereas if you look at something like SCHD, it has a higher yield primarily because it has fewer stocks and can concentrate in those stocks that pay higher dividends. Now, because of these different methodologies, SCHD has a very different sector exposure than VIG. And as a result, because of that sector exposure, the performance has been very different from VIG. So yes, dividend ETFs can be a cushion in times of volatility, but the type of ETF and the underlying index does really matter.
Now, you talk there about sector exposure. What trends are you seeing in dividend ETFs at the moment?
What's interesting is that we had big rebalancings or reconstitutions of these underlying indices in March, and we saw some big changes in some of the underlying ETFs. So, for example, SCHD had a big change where the exposure to energy went up by 8% and the exposure to financials went down by 8%. And we know that this year energy has been an underperforming sector both in the last month as well as throughout this calendar year. As a result, SCHD is down 5%, which is more than the broad market, as opposed to VIG, which is much heavier, as you mentioned, in financials and tech, and has therefore outperformed SCHD. So the sector exposure really does matter. SCHD is much more energy-focused, lower weight in financials, lower weight in tech. VIG has a much higher focus on technology, about 23% in tech. So these differences matter, and the performance of each sector then influences ultimately the overall performance of each ETF.
But tech still...
Now that has brought us to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Bulletin. Do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program brought to you by David Shombe alongside Benedict Simon. Now from Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye. Do stay tuned also for the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut at 16:30.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Mukungulele kwa tuko maikuto wa mina apidi kwa mavchaziva. Mvele kisema app ato kasi nchavu kamso. Zakale liferide. Mise kunani zencha. Kuzwa kwa kushimba lifera zari vuka kuya kwa lifasi na lifera fama kepe. Mvone maikuto amancha a imba app. Mwikutwe kulibusie mba santo ye nyetuna. Mwikole sfera fama kepe marizo hola mina. Amuvone, imba encha ni encha farizwe ikopanya mifuta ya lifera matasa app ilimi kukopanya naha ni kuhasa nyari zira mlimu. Zeni, zefu mani hamasifera sesifa app ya imba kize tatama Elsin, Ehangano, Oshiherero, Omae Muriro, Catholic, Simani Kakarunga,